Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about two movies that are featuring very well-known actors who I think carry the movie. So the first one is Free Guy with Ryan Reynolds. And this movie is definitely for people who like Ryan Reynolds. It is basically his Deadpool character, but the sweeter side of that guy. Instead of being quite so cynical, he's more of an everyman, almost a wide-eyed innocent who finds himself in the middle of a video game. Now, Mike, I'm not a video game aficionado. I know a little bit about them. I don't play them regularly, unless you count Candy Crush Soda, which I'm sure no one will. But I recognized a lot of things about this movie that are love video games, would really find amazing and fun. If nothing else, this movie is fun to watch. What were your first impressions of this movie? Just as a going into it, it's a Ryan Reynolds movie. What were your expectations and how did you think that panned out?
I was not quite as enthusiastic about the film. And admittedly, I'm not a video game guy. So say what you will about me, but it's just not my cup of tea, as I often phrase it. So there's that. Ryan Reynolds, I like well enough, but not particularly a big fan, if you will. So I went in with relatively low expectations. And the film is true to its subject matter. It's very much not just the world of video games, but being inside of one. So it's nonstop noise and action, if you will. It's car chases and gunplay and this and that. Again, not being a video game player, I have that bias against it, if you will. I don't mind stating that. But here's the problem I run into. At feature length, I find it kind of exhausting after a while. I think, oh my goodness, another car chase, another explosion, another this or that. So there's that, you know, I don't care for in terms of personal taste. But I was trying to place it in a larger context. I thought, you know what? It was reminding me of an infinitely better movie, The Truman Show. Mm-hmm. Because in movies like that, you have an artificially created environment, an actual planned community in the case of Truman Show. In the case of Free Guy, it's, you know, the inner workings of a video game, if you will. Don't quiz me on technologically and metaphysically how all this works, but somehow when you're inside the game that way. And the linkage thematically between those two films would be the fact that you have this totally artificial, totally created environment. And within it, you have your protagonist. And again, it could be, you know, anyone as likable as Ryan Reynolds or, you know, Jim Carrey, on and on, you know, like actors that we know and like, you know, you can think, we can draw up a roster of actors to just identify with, you like them. And what if they somehow were inside a world like this? And the significant thematic linkage is the fact that, yes, they're inside a controlled environment, and gradually, in various ways, they start to suspect or realize that something's not right here, something's a little off. And then, you know, again, we're emotionally identifying with them. That was your point, Marie, about Ryan Reynolds. We tend to like an actor like that. So we identify with him as he sort of, in effect, sort of like wakes up to what the reality of the situation is.
I'm glad you mentioned The Truman Show, because that was one of the things that it reminded me of as well. Ordinary guy going through his day. And then one day realizes, wait a minute, is this a set? Am I just in a TV show? Am I trapped in a video game? I love using The Truman Show in my class. I'm not sure I would use this one in the same way, because it's not as much of an awareness of how much of what we think is normal is artificial. How much are we being manipulated by things around us? But I do think the movie is very successful in all the references to other movies like that. And I think it's They Live, Mike, where character picks up some glasses, puts them on, and suddenly understands what all the billboards and advertising is really coming across. And it's this moment of, it was right under your nose all along. And then, you know, the scales fall, you understand what's happening behind the curtain, and you're suddenly aware of the inner workings, the background machinery of life. Now, where this movie, I think, succeeds in a way that we don't might not fully appreciate because we're not gamers, is like Deadpool uses comic book jokes to kind of bolster the character. This uses video game jokes. And I did recognize some aspects of The Sims and especially Grand Theft Auto. So if you were into those games, this would seem incredibly witty and smart and clever. And using Ryan Reynolds is perfect because it just sort of tamps down his Deadpool character. So it's not going to be as violent. It's not going to be as cynical. It's more of a sweeter Ryan Reynolds who's trapped in a video game, and it's surprisingly wholesome. Also, it does have some wonderful action moments. Also reminded me of the movie Ready Player One, which I also liked for the same reason, which was there were moments when you actually felt like you were experiencing what is pleasurable about a video game, where suddenly you're on the roller coaster and you're watching it sort of swallow you up into the visuals where, you know, it's animation, but somehow it feels real long enough for you to sort of buy into it for a moment. And it's those moments like that that kind of work on the Truman Show premise, which is you're just kind of going along for a moment. And then every now and then you get a glimpse of what's really going on sort of subconsciously.
Well, you're making a lot of really good points there. And I thought of the Spielberg film as well. So we've been talking about the one storyline, the central storyline in terms of the Ryan Reynolds character and his life, quotation marks around that, I guess, in terms of what it's like to be alive inside a video game. And again, if you're a gamer in particular, you know, that's going to be of real interest. But I think for any viewer, you know, even though I wasn't exactly enthralled by it, sure, I mean, it holds my interest as I'm watching it. But there was a second aspect of the storyline that did not work as well for me. There's a human character outside the game named Millie, who's an independent video game designer. And she feels that her game design for this particular game that we're in has been stolen by this corporation with a really evil guy at the head of it. And that is kind of cartoonish in another way for me. But what I didn't care for there was essentially they're having a dispute over intellectual property rights. Has this media tycoon, this gamer tycoon, has he stolen her independently developed technology and her game design and all that. And you know, she hasn't gotten her due for it. And so she, you know, in the outside world and he in the outside world are going to have a dispute there between the independent person and the corporate monster, if you will. And then that plays out within the game as well in terms of how the in-the-game characters are dealt with. But what didn't work for me there so much was I understand that at the intellectual level that, you know, they have an intellectual property dispute, you know, it's a copyright kind of dispute. But my feeling was, and this is a very kind of snarky response, but my feeling was, well, you know, the people in Hollywood who make movies like this worry a lot about such issues of intellectual property rights and so on. But I really wondered, frankly, the extent to which most viewers of this film, Free Guy, would really care much about that or worry much about that. And yet the film does take a lot of time actually letting that play out. And ironically, some of the characters within the video game to me started to seem more realistic and more subtle than some of the quote unquote real life people outside the game who are squabbling over intellectual property rights. What do you think?
I think an intellectual property rights is deadly in terms of a plot device. I think that's just goes off the rails in terms of what people are interested in seeing on screen. You will like this movie if you're a fan of the John Wick movies or even the Joker. I thought it had some aspects of both of those just in terms of the action sequences where you see them setting it up and you're just sort of waiting for the deliciousness of the execution of trying to make you believe that this is a video game where anything is possible. Fun things I made notes of was I thought it was absolutely awesome that they used a portal gun. I so want one of these in my life. The only thing that was sort of off kilter about the portal gun in particular is that they used this really awesome technique in a movie that didn't have anything to do with portals. I thought that was sort of a missed opportunity. I feel like they were trying so hard to put a lot of things in there to signal their audience because there's all kinds of Easter eggs referencing other things. I mean, you briefly see Chris Evans as Captain America, you know, begrudging the use of his shield. And there's so many cameos in the movie, even people that aren't even recognized or even you don't even see their face. You know, Hugh Jackman is a small cameo speaking part. And I really did enjoy Taika Waititi as the villain Antoine. What do you think, Mike? Does he actually make every movie he's in better?
Well, anything would help with this film, really, just to try to make it better. Marie, but my initial point in our episode was, you know, in terms of how relentlessly loud and busy this film is. And I realize that's part and parcel of, you know, the video game experience. But Marie, what I'm picking up on again now, and this is what you really so aptly stated, when you mentioned the way in which it seemed like overeager, it seemed almost desperate at times. The way I phrase it is, it's like tossing in yet something else. Let's throw another cameo, another inside showbiz reference, another inside video game history. You know, I mean, it can be a little bit fun, but after a while, it's like a checklist. It's like so busy and so relentless. I'm thinking, you know, just slow down for a minute or just have more confidence in the story you're working with here. To me, it just, after a while, it just seemed like a lot of pop cultural references tossed in the blender. And that's one reason why I found it kind of exhausting after a while. Not exhilarating, but exhausting.
I like that pop culture tossed in the blender, because I think you're really onto something there. But I think that's actually the genius of the movie for the audience it's meant for, because it's very fast paced. It's coming at you a million miles an hour. I think it's enjoyable to watch just as a roller coaster ride. But if you were really into video games, you would want to go back to see what you missed because you were laughing or, you know, flying by you so fast. For people like you and me who aren't necessarily gamers, I think I spent a lot of time thinking, I think Tron did this better, or I think Ready Player One did this better. But neither one of those movies had Ryan Reynolds in it. I think the key to this is Ryan Reynolds. One of the kind of throwaway jokes in the movie that I laughed at was that there was a scene involving a gin that he, aviation gin, which he was part of owning and sold for a whole lot of money. And he even got that in there. So for Ryan Reynolds fans, there were lots of moments of, oh, look, there's the gin. And oh, look, that's kind of a joke for that. That's a joke for that. I think the whole strength of this movie is, after, you know, the pandemic, people coming back into the movies, how are you going to get people to go back into the movies? I think the whole strength of this movie is on pitching it to a particular audience and giving them Ryan Reynolds to watch in a really likable role. So there's no downside.
Well, I think you've correctly identified, you know, what the core audience is. And yeah, I mean, I'm not part of that audience in terms of personal taste. And so I'm just upfront about that. But Marie, you make a really good point. It's giving people what they want. My feeling again over and over again is just giving us so much or too much. And to me, it almost does seem like it's desperate after all. And desperate might not be the right word, more arbitrary. Let's toss in this, let's toss in that. You know, after a while, it just seems like random to me. It seems like overly busy, overly hectic. Can you be overly hectic? Yeah, I think you can.
I saw this, you know, almost by myself. I did try to find a time to watch it when the theater would not be full, just to kind of avoid crowds as much as possible while still going to the movies. What about you, Mike? How many people were in the theater, and were they all like you and I, or were they younger people? What was the reaction in the theater?
Well, honestly, it was a relatively small audience, and I couldn't make much of it that way in terms of response. But it does, what I did notice, and from reading about it as well, and just common sense, it does tend to pull a younger audience as opposed to an older audience. So yeah, it's going to be oftentimes teens, young adults, and so on. I mean, again, I saw such a small sampling of audience. Like you, Marie, it was a relatively small crowd. So I don't want to, you know, unfairly peg it that way. But my common sense hunch is that it's going to appeal more to younger viewers.
Now, I do want to give a nod to some of the cleverness. I did think Revengemin Buttons was just the greatest name ever. There's lots of little throwaway, smart lines for people who aren't all about the video games. But this is a loud and busy movie. Like you said, Mike, that's a great way of summing it up. I do think there is a possibility for some special effects nods at the Oscars.
Well, certainly a film like this will get some recognition in technical categories. You know, how could it not? It's all technique in a way. It would not get any nominations beyond that, I would think. And even within the technical categories, there are a lot of films released in the year that are really first rate on a very pragmatic level of how they use, you know, technology. And here, you know, when you're getting inside a video game, obviously there's a lot of that here. So I don't even know necessarily that it would get nominated that way. But it seems to me that for a gamer audience, and that's what you've been talking about, for a gamer audience, it's a film people are going to watch. And as you say, watch again to pick up on references. And you know, I think it'll have some shelf life that way. It may not have Academy Award recognitions, but so what? It's not made for the Oscar voters. You know, they're not really the core audience for this.
Now, in terms of the missed opportunity, I do think that there is an audience for this. And some of those people would really want to see it in IMAX, the surround sound, Dolby, and all that, to really immerse themselves, almost like VR. But I think the majority of gamers have already found a way to download this and watch it without going to the theater. So I think in a way, they may have been a little too smart about pitching this to a particular group. I don't have a lot of faith in the box office for this, but it's definitely worth watching if you like action and if you like loud and busy. So the second movie we're going to talk about is Reminiscence, which is a Hugh Jackman vehicle. And kind of like with the Ryan Reynolds movie, I think most of what made this happen was the studio signing Hugh Jackman. It almost could have been any project. Now, I think this movie has some things recommended in terms of being a new film noir attempt. But right off the bat, Mike, what was your take on Reminiscence?
Well, I really was not crazy about the film, but it held my interest because of what it's doing or trying to do. It's really a sort of a fusion of film noir and science fiction. And we've had similar examples, you know, Blade Runner type examples. And in some ways, that's the world of the near future or next month, however you want to put it, because this is a story that's taking place in Miami when the city is partly flooded. And of course, that's becoming the case and will in the years ahead. And that's actually quite interesting from the standpoint of production design. You know, it's really interesting to see the skyscrapers rising up through the water. In some cases, you can still drive through the streets, a few inches of water. Other places, you might be in a boat or something. But it's really, you know, from a production design standpoint, it's really quite interesting there, you know, scene by scene, just to see how they treat a city under those conditions. In terms of the storyline, I had mixed to negative feelings. The essential metaphysical thrust of it is that the Hugh Jackman character, he's got this company, and don't ask me, you know, like sometimes in a classroom, students will ask me to explain some like really wild scientific plot twist. Like, I can explain this, but you know, how can they do that? Why did they do it? Like, I know this, you know, but the twist here, and it's really in the premise, is that there's this technology whereby in terms of reminiscence in which you can, as a paying customer, you can like revisit, you know, moments of your life that way and so on. And you know, I don't want to go too deep into the story right now, but the essential kickoff point is that you can somehow revisit past memories like that and live in them again. Now, that works as a science fiction premise. Where I had problems with it was the film, I think, has a really interesting, as I've been saying, production design. I think it, you know, has a premise that really does hold your interest. Sometimes, though, and this is a reservation, sometimes it goes so far and so wild. It's like, well, what are the rules of the game? Like, sometimes you just kind of wonder sometimes, like, you know, what exactly is this doing? How does it work? Why this? Why that? And you don't, if you find yourself having questions like that, the film is starting to lose you. You have to go along completely with the ride, right? If you start to wonder about any element of it. The thing I really saw as a liability was there are going to be some romantic entanglements for the Hugh Jackman character. And there certainly are all sorts of dramatic entanglements in terms of that technology and how it's used or misused. So granted, I give all that. The major problem for me is that oftentimes the dialogue is so hackneyed. It's really, really poorly written in places. And so, you know, a few things started to lose me. One, some of those, you know, real stretches in terms of the technology and what's going on here and why this, why that. Yeah, there's that. And we might all have a somewhat different list of things that, you know, trouble us a bit that way. But I think what should trouble most anyone is if you just listen to the dialogue sometimes, it's really, really creaky. It's really stilted. It's like a bad film noir. It's like a bad sci-fi film in terms of how things are actually phrased. But meantime, there are these romantic relationships that we're supposed to care about. And that's where, for me, there was eventually a kind of real disconnect. And so, yeah, the film always held my interest, but increasingly I didn't particularly like it. I was just tracking it and admiring the flooded streets of Miami, I guess, just because it was sort of a cool look to see what it'd be like to live in a city under those conditions.
You know, with Hurricane Ida hammering the East Coast, the fact that this is, you know, set sort of underwater is a little too real for right now. I agree with you completely about the screenplay. I actually made some notes while I was watching it about the triteness of some of the dialogue. I mean, literally like likening time as being beads on a necklace kind of a thing. You know, just like really tired, hackneyed kind of words. And when you think about classic film noir, you know, it takes a lot of these great, you know, potboiler detective stories that are giving you a glimpse into the underworld, you know, the world of cops and criminals and, you know, bad women and hard luck and reversals of fortune and all of these sort of dark, dark views of the world. It did a nice job of, you know, giving you the, you know, the femme fatale that you're expecting, of, you know, the fact that everything is, you know, there's so much water, all these wonderful shots with reflections in puddles, which are, you know, so classic film noir, a whole lot more use of color than we're used to the classic film noirs from the 40s. But that same feeling that these are not, you know, the stories of upstanding citizens going to their jobs every day and, you know, then coming home and, you know, having a family life. I mean, this is a really unusual kind of story within the dystopia where Hugh Jackman can help people access the past. And where that's intriguing is when you think about the times people do get obsessed with a particular time in their life, the people that you know, maybe even yourself, who at times would like to live in the past. The temptation, if you could go back to a moment to relive it, to stay there. All of those kinds of really interesting human tendencies are suggested out, but then they don't really make the most of that. It sort of devolves into the easier threads that are easier to pull, which is why I think it seemed a little hackneyed, a little bit of a wasted opportunity. Even watching the mechanism for which you go into the past, I found myself saying, wait, didn't we see this in Minority Report? Didn't they do it better?
Yeah, you're right. It's at that level of what I call the mechanics of the film. As you enter into this machine and this machine somehow takes your memories back, there are times where it just seems like, okay, they're hitting that button again. And yet when they do, I don't feel like I'm necessarily learning much more about characters, about their backstories and so on. It just after a while seems like, well, okay, here's the next scene. Here's the next visitation or revisitation of something earlier. And sometimes you're not even quite sure where you are. The way the film is set up is to, you know, well, am I within this memory or is it outside of it? And to me, it just seems like sort of like shuffling a deck of cards, but in a way where you don't have complete confidence in whoever's handling the deck. You really wonder if they're quite sure what they want to do at this point. And the characterizations do tend to be shallow. The Hugh Jackman character has a colleague played by Thandie Newton. And, you know, they're appealing actors. And I actually met her years ago, and she's a very nice person. So I'll let the world know she's a nice person. But the thing is, even though they're appealing as performers, the characters don't really have enough depth to them. You know, they're kind of shallow. And then the femme fatale is really shallow, even by a bad film noir standard. I mean, she's got the va-va-voom, you know, figure, and she's a nightclub performer, and she sings, and she's actually wearing a dress that looks like Rita Hayworth and Gilda. I mean, they're very self-consciously putting her as a film noir heroine. And yet I thought, honestly, she was so superficial as a character, I didn't really care about her. I didn't want to know more even. It's just like she appears like a live action cartoon. But I actually thought that Jessica Rabbit has more personality and more depth than this character May, played by Rebecca Ferguson. What do you think, Marie? Because to me, that was one of the places where the film almost becomes like a live action cartoon, but not a particularly engaging one.
It's funny because I had written down Jessica Rabbit too. There was something really over the top about her that was very cartoony and did make it difficult to not only want to follow the arc of her character, but to truly believe that Hugh Jackman's character was really that obsessed with her. You know, it's just really kind of hard to get a handle on that in a way that, you know, doesn't happen with Double Indemnity. You never doubt for a minute why Fred McMurray is interested in Barbara Stanwyck. It's all gotten across in a, I don't know, maybe just because Barbara Stanwyck's character is so much more relatable than the character in Reminiscence, but I'm not sure what it is exactly, where it goes off the rails. I will say, I think anybody could have played it. It didn't have to be Hugh Jackman. I think the fact that they had Hugh Jackman in it gets people to watch it, but it could have been anybody. I didn't think he brought his Hugh Jackman-ness to this movie. I don't think it's a standout in terms of his career. And I think he's actually a really good actor.
You know, I strongly agree with you. As I was watching him, I thought it doesn't have to be Hugh Jackman. He was just sort of, he was actually some kind of dull even, you know, he just was sort of walking his way through it. Any number of actors could have played that role. And when you mentioned earlier how, you know, his engagement with, you know, his interest in this nightclub performer, this mysterious woman, the femme fatale, it just seemed so forced there, like standard issue, like this has got to be the case, but he didn't feel it emotionally. And since we're talking about science, we can talk about chemistry. You know, in Double Indemnity, that great chemistry between Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck, it's there. You believe they're going to have this tumultuous love affair and so on. In this film here, it just seemed forced and unconvincing even that the Hugh Jackman character would have been so intrigued by her, because we in the audience can see right through her, or at least wonder about her and ask questions like, this is trouble. Watch out. This is trouble. But he just like automatically goes into it because, frankly, that's what's in the script, right? You know, that's what's mandated, that, you know, you're going to have, you know, if Thandie Newton character is the good girl, if you will, and the Rebecca Ferguson character is the bad girl. Can I put it that way? Sort of like, you know, you have these polar opposites. Who's he going to go for? Well, at some point, he's going to go for the bad girl. But the moment you see her, it's like, she's not only trouble, she's just not all that interesting. She's not all that nice, even. I mean, Maria, what do you make of this? Because it seems to me that at that point, it's just, you're left like a big question mark. Like, why? Why doesn't he have enough smarts just to get away from her rather than going after her?
You know, the only thing I can think of is that Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson were both in The Greatest Showman together. And at least in this film, you actually get to hear Rebecca Ferguson sing, and she's got a beautiful voice. So that just sort of seemed like a do-over. Let's just throw him in another film. This time we'll let her shine as, you know, that torch singer. I mean, is that not a film noir staple? But in terms of it being a Hugh Jackman movie, I think it's a little bit of a bait and switch. He's just so incredibly bland in this. And I think it's sort of a missed opportunity. Now, you don't have to see this in the theater. You can stream it through HBO Max. I think it might do well there rather than in the theater. I will also say, in terms of Hugh Jackman, that he is involved in bringing The Music Man back to Broadway. So in all the stuff I was watching about him interviewing about doing Reminiscence, he was quick to pivot that, you know, he's working on bringing back The Music Man. And he mentioned in one of his interviews that this was the first musical he ever appeared in his career, playing salesman number two, and that he was gutted at the time that he didn't get the main role. So, you know, he has a history with this movie or this very famous play. And, you know, one of the things on my bucket list is to go see Hugh Jackman, if not as one man show, then to see him on Broadway. I think that's probably the place to see him rather than in Reminiscence. What do you think, Mike?
Marie, you make a really good point. You know, he's had a very full career. He's a hardworking actor in terms of live theater, in terms of movies and so on. And Reminiscence ultimately is one of his minor films. When you said he was kind of dull in it, I felt the same way. I thought any actor could have played this. You know, he didn't need to. But, you know, honestly, he's a capable actor and he sort of gets through it. But no actor could triumph over some of those lines of dialogue. I'm sorry. You know, even Hugh Jackman, he's just saying the lines after a while. And it's almost like he's on automatic pilot with them.
I almost think they would have been better off with Ryan Reynolds. But that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. You can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you there.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.